The Closing Market Report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from L&M Commodities, a full-service brokerage company serving area farmers with professional market advice and crop insurance products. L&M Commodities has offices in New Market, Indiana, Leland, Illinois, and Terrell, Arkansas.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for July 15, 2010. This is Dave Dickey. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. In agricultural news, USDA wants to make mandated federal budget cuts in discretionary spending. We'll have this and other stories. And in the second part of the show, The Farming World, heard on many of these stations, will dip into the archives for an interview with Suzanne Hale of the Foreign Ag Service. It's all on the Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report, The Farming World.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Let's check how futures settled Thursday afternoon in Kansas City. September wheat settled at 6.05 and three quarters, up 33 and a quarter. December 6.23, up 33 and a quarter. At the Chicago Board of Trade, September wheat settled at 5.96 and a quarter, up 37 and a quarter. December 6.24 and a half, up 36 and a quarter. September corn settled at 3.92 and a half, up 8 and a quarter. December 4.05 and a quarter, up 9. March 4.16, up 8. May 4.23 and a quarter, up 7 and a half. July 4.30, up 7 and three quarters. August beans 10.19, up 21 and a half. September 10.01, up 25 and three quarters. November 9.88, up 26. January 9.95, up 24 and three quarters. March 9.96 and a half, up 22 and three quarters. May 9.94 and three quarters, up 20. August soybean meal 3.07.60, up 9.30. September 2.98.20, up 9.90. August soybean oil 38.59, up 48. September 38.78, up 50. August live cattle 92.40, up 7.5. August feeders settled at 113.37.5, down 25. And July lean hogs settled at 77.85, and they were up 2.5 on the day. And those are Thursday's settlements in Kansas City and Chicago.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Taking a look at meteorologist Drew Lerner's weather highlights, he says that steady drying is likely in the lower Midwest. Crop stress is expected from Kansas through central and southern Illinois to Kentucky in time over the next 2 weeks. Rain will fall frequently from northern Iowa and Minnesota to Michigan in the coming week. Temperatures will be near to above average during the coming week, running mostly in the 80s and lower to a few middle 90s, with the warmest temperatures in the south. A high-pressure ridge is expected in the heart of the Midwest after midweek next week, and temperatures well above average will occur for a few days from July 22nd to July 26th, and then some relief is possible near the end of the month.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group, Indicator, Illinois. Good afternoon, Dan.
Good afternoon, Dave.
So when I came back yesterday from my vacation, Dan, in my mailbox was an email from you, and it had nothing at all in the body of the email, but the subject line said, "Giddy up." And I guess we're getting up right now.
That was the word I used back in early June when I started getting friendly to the market. I was just teasing people. It was time to giddy up. And naturally, we have seen some pretty good strength since early June. There was a scare there in late June when everybody got a little bearish on thinking the acres were going to be way on the high side, and then you had people talking about national average yields in the 168 or 9 level, and USDA got them all straightened out on June 30th, and things have been altogether different since then.
So to continue the picture that we're painting here about giddy up, I know what producers are thinking. They're thinking how high and how fast.
Well, those are naturally the question that we always face each day, and those are difficult to answer simply because things change. I mean, tomorrow at this time, we could have altogether different weather outlook in Europe. We could have a bit different outlook here in the United States, and everything's the plug has been pulled. But when any time you're in a weather market, and then especially when you're in a weather market outside of the U.S. boundaries, it gets a little tricky. But the key force here has been wheat, there is no doubt that the European wheat crop has been hurt. Most of your fundamental people that you talk to, they say, well, we got plenty of supply, plenty of supply, plenty of supply. Well, I will give that to everyone. But when you're shrinking supplies, the market reflects that. And as long as we are shrinking world wheat supplies, the wheat market is going to be hard to break. It's going to want to climb higher because it continues to anticipate that it's going to even be lower than the most recent estimate. And we do that until we stop shrinking supplies. And when we stop shrinking supplies, well, then the market is overbought, and then it has to kind of fall back. The corn number, the corn rally, while it has gotten some help from wheat, it is principally driven by that smaller than expected acreage number that came out on June 30th and smaller supplies for old crop. And I know demand can change, but at least what the trade is looking at for demand for next year, the corn crop, we need a big yield. And when you talk to people, crop conditions and crop prospects may not be quite as strong as what the market really needs to be comfortable. So the market is pricing in somewhat of an uncertainty premium in the market of the actual size that we have in corn. Soybeans is very difficult to find old crop cash beans. They seem to be almost gold at this point. Demand, foreign demand, has been continued strong. Processor demand has been strong. When you've got premium basis levels of 85 cents or better above the board, it's pretty hard to keep the board down. And you're seeing that reflected also in soybeans. And I think there's reason to believe that USDA may have overstated the soybean acreage on the June 30th report, and I think that's also being a factor in this market.
Let's look at some of those fundamentals that you talked about in further detail. We have a lot of chatter now in the media that we didn't have even a week or a week and a half ago about the Russian drought. And I'm wondering, in the move that we're seeing the last couple of days, is this a bunch of Johnny-come-latelys who are speculative buying on the hopes that it'll go higher?
Well, you can look at the open interest in wheat, and this move has been tied to new buying because we have had a rise in open interest basically since that late June low point. So we are getting new fund buying. And the wheat market is such, it's kind of a, it's hard to maybe to explain, but, you know, for the most part, harvest is over with. The large inventory that we have around, whether it's sitting in the commercial elevator's bin, is most likely hedged up. So there is really no selling pressure coming into the market. So when you have the market hedged up, it just allows the market to go higher. There's a vacuum in there because there's just absolutely no selling that comes to place because it's already hedged up or been discounted in the marketplace, and that is what we're seeing in wheat. Like I said, technically, I think a lot of your technicians are going to be looking at something in that 6.25 range for September wheat on Chicago, and then we'll kind of go from there. But the market, if you look at some of your momentum indicators and whatnot, there's reason to be cautious in here because they are kind of at the upper end of the range. But we're getting a major supply-demand fundamental change here with the shrinking supplies in Europe, and the market's reflecting that.
Now, next week, CME Group will institute its variable storage rate plan to encourage convergence between basis and the nearby futures contract. Does anybody understand this?
Well, it takes a while. I've had it explained to me several times. I'm not much of a wheat guy. But it has brought cash bases. It has narrowed the basis levels in wheat. Whether or not this is going to do the trick, we'll have to kind of wait and see on that. The problem with wheat, is like I said, it's all hedged up because there was big carries in the market, and anybody that had excess storage around old facilities that they could store wheat in, people were wanting to buy wheat ownership, and earn that carrying charges with interest rates real cheap. So you kind of had a quasi grain reserve kind of going in place, and I think that's kind of what you got. You got people owning wheat basically to earn carrying charges, storage charges.
This is Tom Rogers with WILL, Illinois Public Media, with a reminder the National Weather Service has a flash flood warning in effect for central Vermilion County and east central Champaign County until 7:30 this evening. Also, a severe thunderstorm watch remains in effect until 9 for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area. Champaign, Coles, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Ford, Iroquois, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, and Vermilion counties. And a heat advisory remains in effect until 7 o'clock tonight for most of that same area. Stay tuned to FM 90.9 and AM 580 for any further weather developments.
It can change. I think people might be stretching it a little bit, saying that it's hard to add bushels. I don't know if I'd quite go that way, but I do know visiting around the Corn Belt, I mean, it doesn't, it seems like the variability of this year's crop is maybe a little greater than usual. Of course, we kind of hear that each year. But I've talked to a lot of key farmers that I trust that's been out in the fields, and some crop scouts and whatnot. And this crop is not to be it's a good crop, but it's I don't think anybody's really super impressed by it. So just that alone tells me that we're probably under last year's level, which was 164.7, and I think USA might be high on that. So, you know, I think at least for right now, yields above last year might be off the table. But we still have 6 weeks of the growing season yet to go.
And then we have the soybeans, and it has its own weather story to tell and the key growing part of the season ahead.
Yeah, soybeans, my guess is looking at USA's balance sheet, they may be a little high on their bean yield. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they're a little high on their soybean planted number. I think that is kind of the key forces behind that market. And today we did take out the April high by trading up in here at 989.75. So we did take out that April high of 987. So technicians do have their eyes set on the January high of 1034. And like I mentioned this morning, this is the kind of stuff that gets you in trouble. But over the past 31 years, the January high in November beans has only held twice. So the odds that we go above the January high have been quite high. Now, the other side of that statistic is 75% of the highs that were the January highs that were taken out were done so by the end of July. So here forward, your chances, you only have a 25% chance that you'll make a calendar year high after July 31st. So it gets a little tricky when you're looking at the historical mathematical perspective of soybeans. But price action and demand for beans does indicate that we're going to give that January high a good solid test before it's over with.
Thanks, Dan.
Very well.
Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group, and he is in Decatur, Illinois.
Support comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stuart-peterson.com.
In agricultural news, President Barack Obama has asked departments to cut 5% of their discretionary budgets, but USDA officials have asked the White House if the department can take part of those cuts in mandatory spending programs, which include areas such as commodity programs, conservation, and rural development. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Kathleen Merrigan, who manages the USDA budget process, told members of the American Soybean Association Board that USDA is expected to spend $149 billion in fiscal year 2011, and that $26 billion of that is discretionary spending. But that Office of Management and Budget expects USDA to propose a $1.5 billion cut in discretionary spending. 70% of the USDA budget goes for nutrition programs, including food stamps, school meals, and the special nutrition program for low-income women, infants, and children. Merrigan also noted that no one wants to cut the Food Safety and Inspection Service, which costs more than $1 billion a year. The Senate Appropriations Committee takes up USDA's budget in a meeting today. Agriculture Undersecretary for Farm and Foreign Agriculture Services Jim Miller joined the call of House Agriculture Committee Chairman Colin Peterson for a simplification of farm programs. Miller says, quote, "We may have gotten to the point that the programs are so complex we don't get the benefits we want." A newly released USDA Government Accountability Office report confirmed what many cellulosic ethanol developers have been saying for the past few years. The U.S. Department of Energy's loan guarantee program is not user-friendly. The Federal Renewable Fuels Standard requires 21 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol and other advanced biofuels to be used by 2022. One of the more difficult aspects of the loan guarantee process is that companies are required to pay application fees in advance. As a result, the GAO study says that companies should be able to file appeals when an application is rejected. Right now, the GAO study says applicants pay $75,000 to $800,000 each time they apply or reapply. The GAO report also states that the Department of Energy was giving unequal treatment to applicants. The report says, quote, DOE treats applicants with nuclear projects differently from applicants proposing projects that employ other types of technologies. Department of Energy officials denied the charge. Two U.S. senators, a Democrat and a Republican, have reintroduced a proposal to reinstate the estate tax, which lapsed this year. Democratic Senator Blanche Lincoln and Republican Senator John Kyle late on Tuesday reintroduced a plan to tax estates over $5 million at a rate of 35%. The estate tax that expired last year had taxed estates at a rate of 45% above an exemption of $3.5 million for individuals and above $7 million for couples. Without action, under current law, the tax will rise to 55% with an exemption level of $1 million. The U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission says its Subcommittee on Convergence is meeting today to discuss recent developments in the wheat markets. The panel was formed in March of 2009 in the wake of complaints from millers and commercial grain companies that wheat futures and cash prices were failing to come together or converge at expiration. The subcommittee discussion comes ahead of an August 5th meeting by the full CFTC Agriculture Advisory Committee, chaired by Commissioner Michael Dunn. The meeting is expected to discuss wheat convergence, among other issues. The CME says it will institute its much-debated variable storage rate plan beginning on July 18th, raising storage rates by 3 to 8 cents a bushel per month to help fix the convergence problem. Four cargoes of U.S. corn are expected to arrive in China in July, as exporters have advanced delivery of some cargoes. China may have booked about 21 cargoes altogether, or 1.26 million tons of corn from the United States. China's National Bureau of Statistics today says that China's rapid growth is slowing. The world's third largest economy expanded by 10.3% in the second quarter over a year earlier, down from the first quarter's explosive 11.9% growth. Other indicators show manufacturing activity, bank lending, auto sales, and other areas all moderating from 2009. June exports rose 35% over a year earlier, but analysts expect Europe's debt crisis to cool global demand. China's latest growth leaves it poised to pass Japan as the second-largest economy behind the U.S. Today's data also showed that investment in China is still growing faster than retail spending, despite efforts to promote domestic consumption. Retail sales rose 18.2% in the first half, but spending on factories and other fixed assets jumped 25%. The Federal Reserve minutes for its June meeting show that Fed officials thought the economic outlook had softened and that further steps to boost the U.S. economy may be necessary. The Fed is now forecasting U.S. economic growth of 3 to 3.5% this year against the 3.2 to 3.7% range predicted in April. As a result of the minutes, investors think the Fed is in even less of a hurry to raise interest rates. And that's a look at today's agricultural news. It's National Tapioca Pudding Day. It's also Gummy Worm Day and St. Swithin's Day. If it rains on St. Swithin's Day, it means rain for 40 days. The Elizabethan rhyme goes, St. Swithin's Day, gif ye do rain. For 40 days it will remain, St. Swithin's Day, and ye be fair. For 40 days twill rain the mare. Swithin was buried out of doors rather than in his cathedral, apparently at his own request, so that the sweet rain of heaven could fall on his grave. In 971, it was decided to move his body to a new indoor shrine. And it is said that the ceremony was delayed by 40 days of torrential rain, a sign of Swithin's displeasure at the move. On this day in agricultural history in 1869, margarine received a patent in France. Emperor Napoleon III had offered a prize for a suitable substitute for butter for use by the French Navy. The winner was made of tallow. Margarine was not made with skim milk until 1872. And in 1879, a patent was issued for the first American Dobby loom. The loom allows small geometric figures to be woven in as a regular pattern by use of hooked jacks and springs. Originally, this type of loom needed a Dobby boy who sat on top of the loom and drew up warp threads to form the pattern. And that's this day in agricultural history. Listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Peter Levitt. Good afternoon, Peter.
Good afternoon, Dave.
You know, there has been a lot of anticipation. I think even a number of months ago, meteorologists were talking about the coming La Nina prospects for this year. In fact, some meteorologists thought they would be here already. They seem to be delayed a little bit. What can you tell us?
Well, the La Nina is on the way. As a matter of fact, this past week, we saw the numbers in the Pacific on the sea surface temperatures get down to more than a degree Celsius below the normal, and that's the criteria at which we start to talk La Nina. Now, officially, you have to have a few weeks of the temperatures at that level or colder, and then they will say that a La Nina has occurred. But it's very clear that we've gone from an El Nino pattern, which is a warm Pacific pattern for the past 18 or more months, has started to shift late this winter, and now we're moving rapidly into the cold pattern, and we think that's going to be the significant pattern over the next year or two, a little bit longer than La Niñas tend to linger around.
And what would be the implications of a La Niña for the U.S.?
Well, La Niñas for the U.S. are associated with a shift in cold air into the northwest and then the north-central states and the warmer temperatures, the above normal temperatures, tend to recede to the south and shift on eastward. And that tends to be a pattern which, in my view, favors generally normal precipitation and a shift slowly to below normal temperatures through most of the Midwestern states. It's not a drought pattern, and it's not a pattern that calls for excessive heat. Now, you might wonder, well, what about the past week or two where we've been exceptionally warm? Well, we're in the transitional process now, but I think as we move through the latter part of summer, we will see a pattern favoring below normal temperatures and really a very pleasant fall pattern. The one thing we have to be careful of, though, is that it's not a notoriously wet pattern, and we do have the problem, especially with the recent heat, of having things dry out. As long as we can keep seeing these showers and thunderstorm events move across at the order of maybe one or two a week, we'll be okay, but we could use a little bit more moisture in this pattern. But we think the La Niña pattern is not a pattern to be feared for the remainder of the growing season.
Are there weak La Niñas and strong La Niñas, and if so, what's the difference?
Yeah, there are, actually. You can get La Niñas that are exceptionally cold and others that are just barely La Niñas. And interestingly enough, some of the more extreme temperatures occur in the so-so La Niñas. You would think, well, the colder the water is, maybe the colder the temperature. It doesn't quite work that way. We've seen some of the most extreme cold weather in wintertime and La Nina-type patterns occur when it was just marginally or just into the La Nina territory. And in a few years when the La Ninas were really quite strong, we never seemed to get those kind of exceptionally cold patterns.
Thank you much, Peter.
Mm-hmm, my pleasure.
That's meteorologist Peter Levitt. Stay tuned, if you will, for The Farming World.
This is The Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we'll talk with Suzanne Hale. Hale is Associate Administrator for the Foreign Agricultural Service. Prior to appointment, she served as the United States Ambassador to the Federated States of Micronesia from 2004 to 2007. As Minister Counselor for Agricultural Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo, she managed USDA's three offices in Japan from 2000 to 2004. And from 1997 through 2000, she served as the Minister Counselor for Agricultural Affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing during China's WTO accession negotiations. Now, as Director of the Foreign Agricultural Services Ag Export Services Division from 1996, she managed USDA's International Trade Show Program, and she worked closely with State Departments of Agriculture and coordinated outreach for new exporters. Administrator Hale, thank you so much for taking time today. Could you answer a quick question for me, which is, what's the mission of the Foreign Agricultural Service? Some of our audience won't know what it is.
Yes, we have two missions. One is to promote agricultural exports, and the second is to promote food security around the world. We represent the interests of U.S. farmers in over 154 countries through our offices around the world. And we do several things. We do a lot of market analysis. It's really important for U.S. producers to have a sense of where global markets are going when they're making their planting decisions and marketing decisions. And so we do a lot of market analysis. All of our reports are up on the internet and available for everyone and everyone to see. We also work very closely with U.S. producer groups like the Grains Council, American Soybean Association, in market development programs to promote exports of U.S. agricultural products. And we also work a lot, very closely with U.S. Trade Representative's office in eliminating trade barriers and improving market access through, we do that through trade negotiations, multilateral trade negotiations through the WTO and also bilateral agreements. And then when we face unfair trade practices, we try to eliminate them.
Are you involved with USTR then as well?
Yes, we work very closely with USTR in several different fora. For example, in Geneva, we've been negotiating a new WTO agreement. And that the goal of that is to have a more level playing field, to improve access for our producers. Then we also work with them in negotiating bilateral agreements, for example, like the North American Free Trade Agreement and the Central American Free Trade Agreement.
And are you involved in the free trade agreements that are currently up on the table but not yet approved?
Well, those are up on the Hill right now, I'm not directly involved in those, but yes, we are working with USTR to fine tune what was those agreements, and then they'll need to be approved by Congress.
Can you tell me about some of the intelligence reports? I see those are listed, the commodity intelligence reports, and what they might tell us about the world.
Yes, I think that one of the main things that we're obviously looking at is what's happening with production. We've got people on the ground that are looking at what crop conditions are like. We have satellite imagery that we're looking at to see what's happening with crop conditions. And so we do a lot, provide a lot of the information on what's happening with international crop production in key competitor countries that's used by USDA's World Outlook Board. When they do their, every month they do an assessment on the supply and demand situation for key commodities. And so the reporting that our folks in the field do are an important part of the analysis that's the basis for those monthly projections.
Yeah, so the World Agricultural Outlook Board will take a look at some of the reports that are coming in from the folks at FAS. If people, farmers, producers, commodity brokers, others were interested in seeing the reports directly, can they do that from your website?
They certainly can, yes. If you look on the Foreign Agricultural Service website, you could just Google FAS, and they're very accessible on our website. And so you can look at the analysis we do. We have sort of summary analysis of all of the reports that we do on a regular basis, but you could also look at the oil seeds report that's come in from the most recent one that's come in from Argentina or Brazil, and actually find out what our people in the field are seeing in terms and what they're expecting in terms of planted area, in terms of expected yields. And so that it's possible not just to get the summary reports, but to go back in and get the actual reports for each country.
And then if you were to get the reports, are they statistical data then, or are they written summaries, or both?
Both. We always have tables that have supply and demand analysis, and then a text summary report. And I think they're also, those reports are also important, I think, for producers in understanding. We also do demand analysis. And so if we are expecting there to be, you know, increase in demand, for example, the demand for soybeans in China has just grown very, very rapidly. And so those reports would track that kind of change in demand, as well as changes in production.
Are you familiar with the ins and outs of the reports at the moment? For instance, what is the economic outlook for China in terms of continuing to purchase soybeans from around the globe at a very rapid pace?
Yes, we are expecting growth there to continue because as people the Chinese economy is doing very, we're seeing good growth there, and as people become more affluent, they're just able to afford more livestock products and more vegetable oil, and that's what's been fueling the growth there, and we expect that to continue.
Have you done reports at FAS on the world economy and the world population growth and projections as to how quickly one and the other will grow and what kinds of needs we'll have for food security around the globe? I think food security is probably a primary mission of the FAS.
Right. Most of our reporting focuses on agriculture rather than on more general topics like demographics, but we certainly use other people's analysis in making in the analysis that we do, and I think there's food security is certainly of a very high priority. We have some really innovative programs. I think probably one of the most successful program has been the McGovern-Dole program, which provides assistance to some of the poorest of the poor countries in providing school lunch programs. And that's good because it improves nutrition of children who really need it, but it also encourages children to go to school and really supports the educational programs in those countries.
How does it work?
We work with partners in those countries and private voluntary organizations. And we will work each year to figure out which programs which countries where the need is greatest, and then we will announce programs in those countries and then work with private voluntary organizations to implement the programs.
Is implementation development of school lunch program content or the meal parts of it locally, or is it purchased from USDA stocks, a combination?
Traditionally, most of it has been provided by the food assistance has been provided by the United States, but recently we have a pilot project to do some local purchases as well.
And the reason behind the local purchases would be to develop it, to develop a local economy for food products?
Yes, and it also, depending on the situation, sometimes food can be provided more quickly if there's a real emergency by using local stocks.
No, so food security is a matter not only then of having available source of food, but an available source in this case of locally grown food, and they're one and the same, but two different things at the same time. One where you have available food, the other where it's locally grown and available.
I think that obviously food security depends on local production and in many cases on trade, and that it's important to. If you really are looking at the entire food security situation, it's important to look at both.
All right. So tell me about the marketing programs of FAS.
Yeah, I think that this year we're expecting close to $100 billion in exports. Next year, expecting $100 billion. The economy is. Worldwide has been suffering, but despite that, we're still expecting the second highest level of exports, agricultural exports ever. And I think there's several reasons for this, but one of them is that we've been working really hard to eliminate trade barriers, and so we have better access than we might have 20 years ago. Another reason is because the world economy is growing and populations are growing, and so just global food demand has been increasing because there's more people in places like China who can afford a better diet. But I think the third reason is because of the partnership that USDA has had with producer groups through using checkoff funds and USDA funds to develop markets overseas.
We're talking with Suzanne Hale this afternoon. She's an associate administrator at the Foreign Agricultural Service. More with her here on The Farming World when we return.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rob O'Malley in Champaign at 217-378-7633. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, Realty Track today says that more than 1 million American households are likely to lose their homes to foreclosure this year. Nearly 528,000 homes were taken over by lenders in the first 6 months of the year. By comparison, lenders have historically taken over about 100,000 homes a year. In all, about 1.7 million homeowners received a foreclosure-related warning between January and June. That translates to one in every 78 homes in the United States. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company says its profit soared 77% in the second quarter as a slowdown in losses from failed loans helped offset a difficult spring in trading and investment banking. J.P. Morgan Chase says it earned $4.8 billion, or $1.09 a share. Analysts had forecast a profit of 67 cents a share. Germany cut its 2010 budget deficit forecast today and says it hopes to comply with an EU-mandated limit a year earlier than expected. Germany cut its 2010 deficit prediction to 4.5% from 5.5%. It also said it expects its deficit to drop to 3%, the maximum allowed under European Union rules in 2012. And U.S. corn exporters at the Gulf of Mexico have doubled the discounts they apply to barges of number 3 grade corn as supplies of the lower quality grain have flooded the market. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World from Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We'll continue now our conversation with Suzanne Hale from the Foreign Agricultural Service. Ms. Hale, before the break, the discussion had turned to the cooperative effort between producer groups and the United States government, in this case through the Foreign Agricultural Service, and how it had been successful. Do you have examples?
Looking back in Japan, just to give, I spent a lot of time there, and just to give one example, when I first went to Japan when I was in college in the 60s, women used to go to the grocery store and buy every day, and they would buy one or two eggs, and which would be wrapped in a piece of newspaper, and they would take it home. And the Grains Council got the idea that if people had egg cartons, that they would be able to buy more eggs and buy, a dozen eggs at a time instead of one or two. And so they introduced the idea of egg cartons, and now everyone in Japan buys their eggs in egg cartons, and it's really increased demand for eggs. I think that that support from the U.S. producers through the checkoff programs has been really important.
This is a bit of an odd question, maybe, but I'm wondering if, for instance, let's take the change in the way Japanese were buying eggs, and they were buying a couple of a time, and then they bought more in a carton, and egg sales went up dramatically, of course, which led to the need for more poultry laying hens and the need for more feed from the United States to come into that. Do you think that was good for the Japanese diet?
Well, I think it, historically, the Japan started from a diet that was really deficient. If you looked at, right after the war, the Japanese diet was very short in protein. I think that the introduction of livestock products is, assured that kids have drink more milk, have more calcium in the diet than they did traditionally, more protein in the diet than they did traditionally. Traditionally, Japanese have eaten a lot of fish, and just in terms of sustainability, fish stocks around the world are getting tighter and tighter, and so that being able to supplement the Japanese diet with more chicken and beef and pork and eggs. It has been important in making sure that there's a balanced diet. And I think that, if you look at Japanese kids, they're just a whole lot taller and healthier than they were 40 years ago.
Is it something that can be replicated, for instance, or is being replicated, whether it be in China or India, or other parts of the world where we have developing nations?
Yes, I think that it's very much being replicated in other countries. Both the American Soybean Association and the Grains Council have active programs in what we call emerging markets, places like in Indonesia, Vietnam, that are where we're seeing the same sort of in improvements in diets as people have more money to be able to afford more livestock products. And then it's just really important to have efficient production. I think and the Grains Council and the Soybean Association have done a good job of working with to improve breeding, working to improve rations, working to improve animal health, and have really helped livestock producers become more efficient around the world.
Maybe you could close with this thought. How is it that the U.S. government, FAS, works to implement these kinds of programs with, for instance, the American Soybean Association or the poultry producers, those agencies that have at their heart a mission of expanding the need for products that are developed by producers or farmers in the United States?
We have two major programs. One is the Foreign Market Development Program, and the other is the MAP program. And Congress gives us money, and then groups apply for those funds. And they will send in a proposal of which countries they want to work in and what level of funding they need. And one of the things that we look very closely at is how much the groups of their own funds they're willing to contribute to the project. And so one of the reasons that the checkoff funds are so important is that for groups that are planning to put a lot of their own money into a project, they kind of have a leg up when they apply for funding. And so then we provide the funding, and then those groups do all of the implementation of the activities overseas, because our staff is limited, and so this kind of approach has enabled U.S. agriculture to just do a lot more overseas than the producer groups could do on their own or that USDA could do on their own.
It's one of the way checkoff funds are spent by the producer groups?
That's right. It's that partnership has been very important over the years.
We appreciate you taking the time with us. We do. We really do. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
Associate Administrator of Foreign Agricultural Service, Suzanne Hale. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You have a good afternoon.